The instruments of service here is a capitalized term. I think I talked to you about it last week. It includes all the drawings, the specifications, any models, any renderings, any axonometrics, any types of 3D drawings, CAD, all that other stuff. So instead of listing that all out, they use the word instruments of services. But what this provision is saying is, while the architect's responsible for the design of the space, and they're the ones that are licensed and everything else, if the owner sees something wrong, they can't just hide their head. So it's kind of like, if you see something, say something. And this says, shall provide prompt written notice. Sometimes you're on the project site and the contractor comes to the owner because the owner's there and he says, hey, this is drawn wrong. Or this we can't build, or I don't understand this drawing. Now, the contractor should be communicating with the architect this as well. But it doesn't always happen, because the contractor knows that Mike Canahan's the owner's rep, and so when they're communicating to the owner's rep, the contractor can assume that that's going to disseminate to everybody. The contractor doesn't have an agreement with the architect, the contractor only has an agreement with the owner. Or the owner may have one of their own consultants, or the owner may see something. If it's discovered that there's an error, omission, or inconsistency in the architect's drawings, you got to raise your hand. And if you don't, and then later that wall falls down, or there's a delay because the contractor can't understand the drawings, and you look to the architect and say, hey, your drawings screwed up, you cost me money. If the owner didn't tell the architect about that, why should the architect have to pay for all of it? There has to be at least some equal share. Now, the interesting thing on the legal side for my job is, how do you prove that the owner knew about this? The owner doesn't say anything. How do you prove that? Well, maybe the contractor says, I told the owner. You know, maybe it's open and obvious. But there's always this in the litigation side of who knew what when. But the contract here says, if you know something, you must tell them. And that's important. Okay? 5.12, the owner shall include the architect, and this is a change, by the way, from the previous versions of the AIA agreement, but shall include the architect in all communications with the contractor that relate to or affects the architect's services or professional responsibilities. This is a kind of a continuation of 5.11. So this was the way the contracts were written before, for decades. The way the relationship went on the project site was, contractor always spoke with the architect. That's how the communication was with respect to, if there was questions, you issue an RFI, which is initials for request for information. You ask for sketches, you ask for more information. So there's supposed to be this natural communication back and forth between contractor and architect. And because the architect's the ones that's designing it, and they are drawing it so the contractor can build it. So it was logical and it made sense. What has happened over the years, though, is owners have become much more actively involved in their projects. These are expensive endeavors for them, big dollars for a company, and everything else. I mean, like the Haribo facility is over $350 million, so it's a big expense. So the owners become much more involved. And the owners hire their own owner's rep, and the owners do this and owners do that. And so what would happen, just like my example, is the contractor would talk to the owner or the owner's rep, and they would presume that the architect found out. Under the previous version of the contract, until 2017, what could happen would be, contractor says to owner, hey, the drawings need to be fixed here. Owner says, okay. Owner doesn't tell architect. Contractor tries to build it. There's a delay. There's problems. More expense. The architect then eventually finds out, maybe the wall falls down, or maybe it delays the project and everything else. And the contractor is looking for more money. So the contractor's like, I didn't do anything wrong. All I did was say, I couldn't understand the drawings, I needed clarity. And when we finally fixed it, it cost me more money. Here's my change order for $50,000. Under the old provision, because the communication was always supposed to flow through from contractor to the architect, sometimes the owner would be like, I'm not paying that $50, you architect need to pay the $50 because your drawings were wrong. And maybe they were. And the architect's like, I didn't know. Why should I pay for it? The contractor went ahead and changed something without even my knowledge. And the contractor's like, well, I told the owner. And the owner said, well, you're supposed to tell the contractor. You guys figure it out. So there became this big fight back and forth because the owner kind of stepped in. So the AIA saw that. There was lots of litigation over that. Lots of times these provisions are changed or updated in these agreements because they see between the 10-year cycle between these versions where more litigation comes. And what it turned out was owners were becoming more actively involved and they weren't communicating to the architect. But then they point the finger at the architect or they point the finger at the architect or the contractor. So if you're going to step in and they communicate between the owner, if the owner becomes the point of communication, this provision says you, owner, now have a responsibility. You can't duck your obligations because you now must tell the architect what's going on. Okay? So and then it continues on. Shall properly notify the architect of the substances of any direct communications between the owner and the contractor otherwise related to the project. And then, but then it finishes. This is a kickback or a pushback from the architect side. What you don't want to have happen is you don't want to have the architect calling the subconsultants. Like, you don't want to have, like, let's say the contractor comes to the owner and says, hey, you know, the engineering for the light fixtures was wrong. You know, the electrical for that was wrong. We need to change that. What you don't want is the owner calling the architect's electrical engineer. Because that's an interference with the contract between the architect and the electrical engineer. You have the owner who has a contract with the architect call the architect, and the architect handles it downstream. So what was, obviously by this provision, what was happening was owners were doing the end around, and they're starting to talk to the electrical engineers and the HVAC guys and everything else. So the architect pushed back and they say, we need some protection, so we want this front end. You have to tell me, owner, everything you talk to about the contractor if it's important to the project. And oh, by the way, owner, don't do an end around me and don't talk to my subconsultants. And there's similar language in the owner-contractor agreement. So you think about it as a triangle. Again, I'll say this throughout the semester. At the top of the triangle is the owner, and at the two corner points is the contractor and the architect. There's solid lines between each one on those two legs of the triangle. Owner to contractor, owner to architect. There's no solid line on the bottom of that triangle. There's no connection legally. The solid line is your contract. And then underneath those two bottom points of the triangle are all the subconsultants. And the owner doesn't have a connection with them either. So the owner really should be communicating owner-contractor only and owner-architect only. And that's the way it all works, at least for legal purposes and otherwise. 513, before executing the contract for construction, so that's what's going to be with the contractor, the owner shall coordinate the architect's duties and responsibilities set forth in the contract of construction with the architect's services set forth in this agreement. I think I talked about how the AIA, why they're good as a suite of documents. They all have the same language. They all relate to each other. And there are mere provisions. And that's what this is saying is, we have a contract between owner and architect. And when we enter into the contract with an owner and contractor, whatever my duties and obligations owner, and whatever your duties and obligations architect, whatever is stated in this owner-architect agreement, has to be translated into the owner-contractor agreement. And you're like saying, well, Mike, if these suite of documents, if these AIA documents are all interrelated and everything else, why do we need this provision? Because, you know, we're going to have an owner-architect agreement. Aren't they automatically going to be in the owner-contractor agreement? Yes, they will. But owners don't always use the same contract. They may use an AIA contract with the architect because the architect provided them an AIA contract. And then when they hire the contractor says, here's my contract, and it's not an AIA. And then you get in trouble. You have inconsistencies of terms. And then the architect is trying to protect themselves and saying, hey, I didn't negotiate that contract with you and your contractor. I would have told you to use an AIA, but you didn't. So if the contractor is asking me to do more things or different things, I told you here you need to coordinate my services over there. So that's what this is trying to do, is make sure we conserve consistency between them. And then it also says, hey, by the way, owner shall provide the architect with a copy of that contract with your contractor. You know, I want to make sure that you gave, that if you use the AIA, which should coordinate our services mirrored, you didn't change them. I want to make sure if you use a different document with a contractor that it properly tracks. So you got to give that contract to the architect. The other reason why the architect wants to have that contract is during the construction administration phase, that was phase five that we talked about last week, the architect's going to walk the project site. They're going to look at the building and what's going on. And they're going to want to read that contract that the contractor has. So when the architect says, you need to change this, the contractor's like, no, I don't have to do any of that. And then the architect can look at that owner-contractor agreement and say, yes, you do, because in this contractor agreement that my owner gave me, it says you have to do this. So they're going to make sure, that's why you want to give to the architect everything that you signed with the contractor. It's kind of logical, but you want to put it here to make sure everybody knows the rules of the game. And then at the bottom, 515, within 15 days after receipt of a written request from the architect, so the architect has to have a written request, the owner shall furnish the requested information as necessary and relevant to the architect to evaluate and give notice or enforce lien rights. Does anybody here know what a mechanic's lien is?
Is that like when you complete a project, but they will pay for the completion
of the project? So your scenario is great. So he said, is that when you complete a project, but you don't get paid for the project, and you want to get your money? So the scenario is exactly when a mechanic's lien arises. And so, but the mechanic's lien is actually, I don't know if you guys have heard, but there's a concept of term of a lien on a property. And so what ends up happening is, you, the owner, own the property. And the architect or contractors, if they're not getting paid, will actually file a lien on the property. And a lien is actually a super right. It stands even above your mortgage. And so most people that have a mortgage on the property, there's a provision. You know, I don't know if any of here has ever bought any property, but when you sign mortgage documents, the type is like as small as you can read, and they still use the giant legal size paper, and it's just pages and pages and pages, and you have to sign every page. You never read it all. But in there, somewhere in that mortgage document, probably there's language that says, if a lien is filed on the property if it's not cleared title within a certain period of time, the bank can foreclose on you. And so what happens is, it's a very powerful tool, a mechanic's lien, that if a contractor, a subcontractor, an architect, or a consultant for the architect, if they're not paid, and they should be paid, they will file a lien on the property that will cause the owner's bank to get upset, and the owner wants to clear title, their title to the property, and so that helps to ensure that payment is made. And so if what happens here is, if there's an issue, and the architect doesn't have the information on where to file the mechanic's lien or what have you, this says if the architect asks for this information, you need to give it to it within 15 days, because there's a very brief period of time of when you can file a lien. If you haven't been paid, you have a certain window of when you can file a lien on the property. So it's very important, and this is, again, a protection that's put in for architects to say, hey, I did the work for you. You can't not pay me. That's not fair. So that's a protection in addition to a breach of contract action, because obviously they can always sue in a contract. I did the work. You said you pay me $10,000, and you make $10,000. That's our simple breach of contract expectation damages. This is a different right. I did the work. You're not paying me. I'm going to lien your property. And if you don't pay me, I'll sue you for breach of contract, and I'll foreclose on your property. So it's a different type of way to secure your interest in payment that's due. Any questions on owner's responsibility? So what I want you to think about when we get to the test is, I'm going to have maybe a scenario or two that'll be like, most of my questions are going to be 4-5 sentences, kind of a fact scenario, and then it's a multiple guess. You know, what would you do for this or that? And some of them it's going to be, you know, none of the above, all the above, the typical things you're going to see in a multiple guess type question. So what you want to think about for owner's responsibilities is, when you go back and look at it, is what things make sense that the owner should do, and how that applies. So kind of like, that's why I've given you examples, and that's why I try to give, almost every time I give a provision, I try to give an example of how it's going to be applied in the field. And so, like, you know, if even to some of the questions that are asked, like there may be a scenario that says, and I haven't written this part of the test, so I'm just kind of making it up as I go here, but, you know, owner goes in and doesn't have soil borings done in a property. We'll just use your example. Doesn't have soil borings in a property in Chicago. The building is built, and there's differential settlement. Which of the following best describes the scenario that we're in? And it could say, could be both, could be neither, could be architect, could be owner. That type of thing. And depending on how the way the scenario is written, that's how you want to think about it. What were the owner's responsibilities? And the key is, and this is what I find in the test, the key is to read the facts. we will go through, by the way, in one of our classes, and I'm trying to see if we can do it at my office, and I can feed you guys beer and pizza and stuff, but we will go through, and there's times when I go through the class, and we'll say, well, I'll read the provision, and maybe everybody will pick the answer C, and the answer is B. And also, the reason why I say answer is B, and I'll show like three words in the sentence that says, this didn't happen, and everybody will miss that, because it's important to how you read the fact scenario. If I get a question like that where everybody picks C and the answer is B, I'll probably fill the question out because maybe it was too confusing, so I do that with my graded test. But that's what you want to do, is you want to kind of read it and think about it and how those apply. So back to the owner's responsibilities, like what are the logical things that an owner must do with respect to their responsibilities? Okay. Cost of work. We talked about cost of work last week. I threw up articles 6.1 and 6.3, so we're finally getting to that here. But I want to just reiterate it one more time. The cost of the work shall be the total cost to the owner to construct all amounts of the project designed or specified by the architect, and shall include the contractor's general conditions, costs, overhead, and profits. So let me break this down so we can understand. So cost of the work is a defined term. So you're going to see this in almost every construction contract you ever say. Sometimes it's cost of the work, sometimes it's just cost of work. They sometimes shorten it up and get rid of that. The work is also going to be, when you see in a construction contract, the term work by itself is also a defined term. And in each instance, it's always going to be tied to the construction of the project. The work is what the contractor does. Architect provides services with a capital S. That's the design work the architect does, and the phone calls and the coordination and everything else. So the services are what was in Article 3, those five phases. And in this contract, it's called basic services because we know we have additional supplemental, but it says services with a capital S. The work with a capital W is the contractor's work, and that's why the definition of the cost of the work is tied only to the construction side of it. Okay? So that's the first part. The second part of the sentence is, shall include the contractor's general conditions, overhead, and profit. Who here knows what the term general conditions means in construction? Anybody? Okay. So general conditions are, if you want to think about a general contractor, some general contractors have divisions they self-perform work. I'm working with a general contractor right now that they have people that do concrete, they do carpentry, and they do what's the other one that they do? Concrete, carpentry, labor, and... Oh, masonry. So they do... There are three things they do primarily is they do masonry work, they do concrete work, and they do carpentry work. All of the other trades do the other stuff, electrical, plumbing, you know, all the other stuff that when you build a house or build a building or whatever it is. So the general contractor sits on top of all those people and they control all those people. And included in is when you have to negotiate a contract with your subcontractor to do plumbing. There's costs that the general contractor incurs to negotiate that contract. Time and effort and paperwork. As the invoices come in from all the subcontractors, they got to hire someone in their offices that goes through and does all the administrative work, does the billing, and puts the bills together to send to the owner. The contractor has to have insurance, so they have to pay for insurance. The contractor has to rent a trailer on site. On the trailer on site, they have to have maybe a printer. They have to have the desk. They pay the electrical bill for that trailer. All of those costs, they're not actually physically building the structure, are what's called general conditions. Every single construction project, the contractor will have general conditions. So it's not the work of swinging the hammer and putting up the lumber, but it is necessary for the construction of a project. So that's why the cost of the work here, because we have work as capital W is defined as the actual work building the project, but it says, and shall include general conditions. And then we have overhead and profit. Profit is obviously everybody is in the business to make money. The overhead may be some of the stuff that goes on back at the home office or what have you. And different contractors categorize general conditions and overhead. Sometimes overhead and general conditions kind of mesh together. It just depends on how they present it to you. But you just got to think about it. a construction project has more cost than the actual work being performed. So that falls into this definition of the cost of work. And the reason why I go over this in such detail is because, again, a lot of times the architect's price will be based on a percentage of the cost of the work. The contractor's fees and insurance rates and everything else will be based on the cost of the work. So the cost of the work becomes this driving factor as to how people make money, basically. What's their profit? Because if the architect's fees are based on the cost of the work, if the contractor's markup is based on the cost of the work, if the contractor's insurance is based off the cost of the work, all of those are driving the profit centers of how the business is done. So that's why it's important to know. Now, it does continue to go on. It says, does not include the compensation of the architect. So whatever you're paying for the architect is not included in the cost of the work. Cost of the land, it's not a cost of work. Rights of way, financing, contingencies, all this other stuff is not included. If you were looking at the owner, and this is important when the owner's setting its budget, the owner normally should have two budgets. They should have a budget for the cost of the work. Architect, I want you to design this house for a million dollar house. That's a cost of the work budget. So when I'm sitting down with my wife or whoever the owner is, and you're going to have this, we're like, we have a budget of $1.5 million. That's the budget for the project. The project includes my architect's fees, my land, my insurance, my legal fees, and the cost of the work. So the project, if you want to think about it, is on the umbrella, is everything that goes in. And then you have services, that's the architect stuff, you have land, and then you have work. And so project budget is going to be different than the cost of the work budget. And you don't. And a lot of times what's going to happen is the owner will never tell the architect nor the contractor what my overall project budget is. That's private. I need to let you, architect, know you got $1 million to design this house. And then you know, contractor, once you bid, that if it came in, that's your price for the cost of the work. That's what you need to know. You don't need to know what I'm going to spend on landscaping or what I use to pay the property for the property taxes or any of that other stuff. You just need to know the cost of the work. But owners should have those two budgets. Question? Permits would go into the cost of the work. So, now, what's interesting about that, that's a really good question, because when we get to the construction contract in a couple weeks, there is discussion about who pays for the permits. And so sometimes the provision will say, the owner shall pay for the permits. What ends up happening typically is the contractor gets it and they bill for it through their normal billing, but sometimes the owner will write the check separately. And so sometimes that pay for the permits and the cost of that, the owner may put that in their own budget because if it's not being funneled through the contractor. So a lot of it has to do when you're sitting down with a contractor and looking at their spreadsheet of what the costs are, there may be a line item the contractor has for permits and surveys and those types of things, and there's going to be a dollar figure, and that would be the cost of the work. But if the owner wants to pull that out and put it over here so there's not a markup on that, he can move it over here, she can move it over here to the cost of the project. So that sometimes can be just a negotiation. Question? Yes. So the question is, for people who didn't hear, is there some type of, I don't know if you meant obligation or you said just some role where the architect communicates with the owner about the budget, because remember we have estimate and budget, and should the owner be doing, or the architect be doing that, especially if it's a first time an owner? The answer is yes. And if you remember back in one of the in the preliminary services, that it says the architect shall confer and meet under schematic design with the owner in establishing a budget. And that's that communication that happens in the beginning. Now, what architects will do, and this is not a dispersion to architects. I think, in fact, they do this because it's probably good business sense in some ways. Many architects, if you remember at the end of each one of those schematic design, design, development, and construction documents, at the end of each phase it says, the architect shall provide an estimate, and then the architect shall provide an updated estimate. It's like the last sentence in each one, last paragraph in each one of those provisions. Many architects these days cross that out. And they say, we don't have a cost estimator on staff. We don't do that. And a lot of times they don't want to do that because they don't want to be found liable later on if they blew the estimate. I have a budget of $1 million. You gave me an estimate of $900,000. It went out to bid and it was 1.4. What the heck was going on there? You totally blew your estimate. I was believing you all the line, all the time. Now we got to redesign. That's going to cost me more money. I can't open my candy factory. What all the problems are. And so architects don't want to be in that quagmire because, again, time is money. If it delays, the architect has to redesign. So many of them will strike the any estimating and any dollar, even the negotiations or helping with the budget in the beginning. They're like, we're out of that. What I often will tell my owner clients is ask them if they will engage or hire a cost estimator. Somebody needs to do that. If you have the architect saying, we don't want to be responsible for cost estimating, and it's an expensive project, as me representing an owner, I'm going to say, you want somebody to help you with your budgeting. If you don't, you're being stupid. I mean, I hate to say it that way, but if you're going to be spending $50 million, you want to have somebody making sure that the $50 million is going the right way. So either you, owner, have to hire a cost estimator, or they do. Why won't you have, well, doesn't it make more sense that they do? You don't do this for a living. Again, hire someone to do that work. And the architect will say, okay, we will retain someone, and they'll keep that, we'll provide that estimating language. That'll stay in the contract. They'll keep that. But they will pass those obligations downstream. So they have an obligation to provide an estimate. Then they enter into a contract with a cost estimator. The architect enters into a contractor with a cost estimator. And in that cost estimator contract, it says, you, cost estimator, have an obligation to do your job right. And so when the estimate comes in for that, it comes in at $950,000 and it's $1.4 million, the owner looked at the architect and said, what are you doing? The architect just pushes that responsibility downstream. So it's fair because the owner's still protected. And in this case, the architect doesn't take on a responsibility he doesn't want to do, but everybody's happy, and it should work out better. You know, in this case, more information is better. But as a general purpose for this contract in its native format, there's a provision in I think it's 3.1 or 3.2 that says the architect shall engage with the owner and assist with creating a budget. And then the owner must update that budget as we move along. So, good question. 6.2, the owner's budget for the cost of the work is provided in the initial information. That first paragraph, the owner shall say, here's my budget. Now, a lot of times the contracts are signed without a budget because they haven't even gone through the schematic design phase where it says the architect's going to help consult on the budget. So sometimes it's not uncommon that I have a contract signed where the budget isn't provided, but eventually it gets filled in. Then it says, and may be adjusted throughout the project as required under sections 5, 2, 6, 4, and 6, 5. So there are obligations or checks and balances. This contract recognizes that not every owner will have a budget going in, and so that it will still be updated and provided. Evaluations of the budget for the cost of the work, the preliminary estimate, that's the architect's responsibility of the cost of the work, and the updated estimates of the cost of the work prepared by the architect, represent the architect's judgment as a design professional, not judgments as a cost consultant, not judgments as an accountant, not judgments as a contractor. It's their judgment as a design professional. They want to keep that within that 2.2 standard of care. An ordinary architect providing architectural services in this locale for this type of project. Now, a good owner will do their homework, and they'll say, I'm going to hire an architect that's designed hospitals. So when I get that preliminary estimate from the architect, they should be sophisticated in those dollars. I'm going to hire an architect that knows how to design a high-value house. So when they're getting these estimates, the owner can rely on them. You don't want to hire someone to design a hospital that's never done one and say, oh, your budget was wrong, your estimate was wrong, not your budget, your estimate. So it's not an obligation, but there's a good business sense that the owner should bring the right type of designer in so they can rely on this information. So at least it would fall in with this scope of design professional. But again, the architect's not a cost person. They're not a contractor. They're just giving their best judgment as a design professional. And then at the very end here, the architect cannot and does not warrant or represent the bids or negotiated prices will not vary from the owner's budget for the cost of the work or from any estimates the cost of work evaluation prepared provided by the architect. So what this says is, I told you 950. I know your budget was a million. I'm not guaranteeing anything. This is kind of like at the end of the day at the bottom. It says in the middle, I'm just a design professional, and I know I'm giving you these estimates, and I know you're relying on them, but this bottom provision says, if I got it wrong, it's life. It's kind of the get out of jail free card for the architect. And it should be. And this is why when I have architects come to me and want to strike out that estimating language in the phase 3.1, 3.2, and 3.3, I point to this and I say, guys, you have this kind of clause here that protects you. I think I need you to provide me estimates along the way. And a lot of them will still say no. So you have to kind of give and take in the negotiations. Now, one thing I will do, and it's not in this provision, I will put in here, in this clause, if I'm representing an owner, I will leave this language generally the same, but I will add, but if the bids are 10% higher than your last estimate, you need to redesign for free. Because I'll give you some wiggle room. 10% could be a lot. But it needs to be within 10%. I had a project that... this very thing happened. We had an estimate from the architect for the cost of the work. It was $160 million. And the project came in at $177 million. So $17 million over budget, over their last estimate. We had a 10% markup. So they had $16 million to play with. If it came in at $176 million, we would have had to have been stuck with it. And we needed to make some redesigns because the budget, the owner couldn't afford the $177 million. And so we had a 10% cap in the architect's agreement. And the bid came in at $17 million over the estimate. And so I said, guys, you're 10.8% over the cost. You're over your 10%. You need to redesign for free. There was a lot of stress, but they wanted the client and everything else. But there was a number of communications back and forth between me and their project manager. Luckily, their lawyer, well, I don't say luckily, their lawyer never got involved. Ultimately, the architect did the right thing and they did a good job. But it was important because in the beginning, when we went back, like the price came in, the board for my owner was like, we can't afford this. What happened? They told us it was going to be this. They told us it was that. And they were very upset, and I called them, and we sat down and talked about them. I said, you guys have a 10% margin here. There's $17 million. They have $16 million to play with. We're going to go back to them and push them on it. And again, we worked through it, but this happens. So I give them this wiggle room here. They're entitled. They're just an architect. But $17 million is a lot of money. So for this client. So they decided they came in, and it helped. 6.3. In preparing estimates for the cost of work, the architect shall be permitted to include contingencies. Contingencies are the what-ifs. You know, this may happen. For design, bidding, price escalation, materials, equipment, component systems, and what construction to be used, to make reasonable adjustments, to include alternate bids. So what this is doing is saying, hey, things also happen. Like we were working on projects. I don't know if you guys had probably not as much knowledge of this. During 2021, so it was after COVID, but one of the professions that actually never slowed down during all of COVID, you know, everybody started working from home and a lot of businesses went under and the restaurants were doing terribly and everything else. The one business that boomed, that never slowed down, was construction. It's because you could do it outside and you could be far enough away from people. And we would build in COVID protocols and everything into the contract, and I had a couple projects that did shut down because they had to bring in testing and everything else in the very beginning. This is even before the vaccine. But because of that, there was so much construction that the price of lumber went through the roof. You couldn't get 2x4s to build projects. And so actually, people would then shift to using steel studs, which had always been more expensive than the price of a wood stud. But wood studs were actually more expensive for a period of time, short period of time in the summer of 21, than wood. Or the wood was more expensive than steel. Well, if an architect puts together an estimate based on doing a blueprint wood stud house, and the wood goes through the roof because of something like COVID, supply chain issues. I mean, there's been times in, back if you go back in the the mid-teens, 2010s, there was a lot of problems with getting copper and other different types of metals for electrical stuff because of all the building and construction was going on in China, all the other side of the planet. There were huge projects in New York and Boston, giant high-rises that literally shut down because they couldn't build, because they couldn't get in copper, they couldn't get in the materials. All of those price escalations will affect an architect's estimate because they're estimating on normal life that goes on. So if a project, if that project that I had was $160 million, went to $177 million, the $17 million over budget, if that went that way because of a price escalation, this clause says the architect is not responsible. It's being fair and reasonable. So that's something that happens that you want to make sure you take into consideration. 6.4. If the bidding and negotiation phase, so that was phase four of the four or five phases at work, if it has not commenced within 90 days after the construction documents are submitted to it, the owner's budget for the cost of work shall be adjusted to reflect the changes in the general level of prices in applicable construction market. This is just saying, hey, things go up. I mean, I just read an article today, here we are in the first couple of weeks of February, and they are saying that the prices of gas are going to escalate. I mean, everybody knows gas goes up starting in May and into June, and the summer prices of gas are always more expensive than the fall, winter, and spring. And that's a market-driven thing, so you always kind of expect that. But things will happen, and that's why they put a 90-day window here. If the construction bids, the documents aren't going out for bid for a certain period of time, we as the architect need some flexibility on what our budgets and our estimates are going to be, and you as the owner have to recognize if it's going to take some time for you to bid it, your budget may need to change. Just, you know, and 90 days is sometimes you can change this to 120 or 180, depends, but this is where the AIA stands. And then 6.5, if at any time the architect's estimates for the cost of the work exceeds the owner's budget for the cost of the work, the architect shall make appropriate recommendations to the owner to adjust the project size, quality, budget, and the owner shall cooperate with the architect. So here, what this provision says, if when the bids come back, we blow the budget, the architect's not responsible here either, other than saying, I'll help you fix it. But it doesn't say I'm going to do things for free necessarily. It doesn't say it's my responsibility. It just says if we blew the budget, we'll work to figure this out. And again, it's the protection of the architect. And this may be, it's either sometimes 6.2, sometimes it's 6.5, where I'll put that language in, I'm sorry, 6.3 or 6.5, where I'll put that language in that 10% kicker. It just depends on where the negotiations happen. So. And then, if the owner's budget for the cost of work conclusion is exceeded by the lowest bona fide bid, so the bids all come in, so this is when we've blown the budget, the owner shall increase its budget, that's the owner's responsibility, try to read a bid or renegotiate, terminate this contract. It's too expensive for me to do the project, I'm just done. Here's your money for you doing your work, architect, thanks very much, we're done. In consulting with the architect, revise the program, let's remove some stuff, or implement any other mutual acceptable alternative. Again, nowhere in here, and that's because it's an architect's agreement, nowhere in here does it say the architect must pay for more stuff if they blew the budget. And that's fine as long as the owner recognizes that. And I'm not advocating that the owner should force the architect to pay for stuff, but you want to have some type of hammer, carrot, and stick. You know, architect, I want you to perform good, I want you to do good designs, we have these checks and balances that are in, providing estimates and everything else, but I need to have a little bit here to make sure that you can pay for if you are too far over the budget. That's where I will add in this cap, the 10%, 8%, whatever the negotiation is. And then, if the owner chooses to proceed under 6.6.4, which is revise the program, the architect, without additional compensation, so this is where the architect does have to do things, modify the construction documents to comply with the owner's budget for the cost of the phase of the work. What happens is the architects frequently strike this provision. This is where they say, I don't want to have any responsibility. But they try. So this is an owner-driven provision. So all the provisions up to here say, architect not responsible. This one says, if the owner wants to do a complete redesign of the project, then the architect should do it for free here, but it's very limited in what basis is in. This is where, again, you're going to have lots of negotiations. Okay? Any questions on 6, Article 6? Copyrights and licenses. I'm trying to think how fast I want to go through this because I'm looking at timing. Right, so here's what I want to give you kind of like an overview of copyrights, and then we're going to punch on a couple of highlights there. There will be a few questions on the exam on copyrights, a couple. We cover copyrights later on in the second semester as well, so that's why I think we can get through this part a little bit quicker because we started so late. As a general statement, and I gave you guys the example of the design, the lighting company that I represented, and their designs were being used for the owner terminated them, brought another architect in. They were building the building, and we never got paid. There was a $400-some thousand outstanding invoice to my client, the lighting designer. And we ended up going in an injunction because we said we didn't want to file a mechanics lien, that would take too long. We didn't want to do a breach of contract, that would take too long. So we went in an injunction saying, you are violating my copyright. I own the designs for that lighting reflective ceiling plan throughout the building. So what you want to think about, for you as an architect, your work product, your services, is how you make your money. And there's contract rights to protect yourself, and there's all these things that we've been talking about. But as a creative designer, you are creating something that can be copyrighted. And that is a piece of leverage that you have over everyone. And if someone is improperly using your drawings, you need to protect that. If someone has taken your drawings and stolen that idea and has designed something and built something else and without you being paid for that, you need to protect that. So one of the strongest rights you have, whether it's in this agreement or in general, is a copyright in your design. And you can use that to your benefit. Now, filing an infringement action and all these other things is expensive, but it is something that is a very powerful tool. And you, as an architect, do not want to give up copyright ownership. And this provision is written that way, and I'll go through and show you where. There are going to be some owners that are going to say, you must give me copyrights, your copyright, in this design. To the extent you can, push back and say, I will give you a license, and I'll explain the difference between ownership and license. But you want to make sure you can hold on to that. But again, there's going to be certain owners. If you really want the project, you're going to have to give up the copyright. Did you have a question? Okay. So that, as a just general overview, kind of think about that. It's really, really important to your practice. And I emphasize that. I've used it a few, like, I use the lighting scenario, as an example the most because it's really clean, it's an easy example. We went to court, we got the injunction, we got paid in 2 weeks. It was one of the best implements of using copyrights in the court system that I've ever had in my career, which was great. There have been other ones that are more messy. I had a case where there was a home designer, very unique design, and he was retained by a homeowner. I want to say it may have been up in Wisconsin. I know it was north of the city, but it was in the 50-mile radius. It was in the forest area. Could have been in Lake Forest, I don't even know. But he had a series, the architect had a series of interlocking circles, and it kind of was like a crescent moon shape, and there was different sizes of circles of how these different rooms and spaces interacted with each other in different levels. And it was quite a stunning design. It was very unique, obviously. Lots of white spaces and how the glass curved and things. Really cool. And then the price was too expensive, so they fired the architect. That was fine. He got paid for his services. And then about a year and a half later, he saw largely his design in the cover of a magazine. And an architect won a prize for it. And he was like, this is my house. It made it on a cover of a magazine. He didn't get any recognition for it. And the owner took the designs that the architect, the sketches and everything he had, hired a new architect. They built it for a cheaper value. Whatever they did, there were some modifications and alterations. And then the guy won this award. So he called me up, and he's like, what can I do? And I said, you can sue him for copyright infringement. And then I gave him a budget. And I said, your damages are, I go, did you get paid for your work? And he said, yeah. And I go, your damages would be what you would have been paid if you had finished the project out. We could potentially get statutory damages, which is in the Copyright Act, that you can get that. But I said, I gave him an estimate of what his, probably the max he's going to recover. And then I told him what the cost of the legal fees are if we had to take this all the way through. Because it wasn't exact, so it was going to be a little bit. And he didn't want to do that, which I understand. Hiring lawyers are really expensive. So he hired me to write a cease and desist and a letter to the magazine and a letter to the architect. And the magazine retracted and made a statement, and the architect kind of made a culpa, and the owner, I don't know if the owner had some minor, I didn't get involved with the previous owner and my client, but there was some resolution that we were able to do. We didn't have to go in prison. But there's things that happen. There was one other example I was going to give. Oh, the other example I had was, and this has a dual part story to it. Probably 20 years ago, you guys are all familiar with like Hard Rock Cafe and Rainforest Cafe and some of these themed restaurants. So they were like Planet Hollywood was one that came into vogue. Like for a period of time, everybody was building these kind of themed restaurants where you walk in and something was going on. And so there was this group, I called them the Irish Cowboys. They were a bunch of investors from Ireland. And they put together this theme of, I think it was called 2112, Mars 2112. And it was, if you had walked into a restaurant, that you had landed on Mars and you were in the year 2112 and you had been on Mars. So the space theme and the cool lights and everything else. And they hired this architectural firm, and they I think they're out of Philly, if I'm not mistaken, and they built their first restaurant in New York City. And they were going to come out and they were going to do one here in Chicago. I think it was going to be out by Woodfield Mall or whatever. It was their second one, and they were going to try to become the next Planet Hollywood or Rainforest Cafe or whatever. Apparently it was doing very well in New York. And so about, early on in the development of the Chicago project, the lead designer for the architectural firm quit and opened his own shop and took all the drawings with him because he was the lead designer on the first one. And the Irish Cowboys hired the guy that left to design the space. He's like, yeah, he's our guy. He'll design the space. Well, he stole all the drawings from my client, the architect. And so we got into a series of arguments about copyright infringement, and there was trade secrets and a lot of stuff that was intellectual property because the guy literally stole the drawings. And we had a good case. The problem with it was there were some issues with whether the architect was licensed or not. Not the one that spun off, but the architect that they had hired to do the restaurant before. But he was licensed in Illinois. And so there's questions about whether they could get paid, and we'll get into licensing in another lecture, and I'll kind of expand on this then. But whether that architecture firm actually had a right to bring a lawsuit, because they weren't licensed in the state of Illinois. So can you bring a lawsuit if you're not licensed, even if it's for infringement? So there were some problems with the case for that. But that was another situation where the copyright was the driving force. You stole my drawings, so you always want to protect that. So that's kind of my overview on this. I'm going to bounce through what these mean in this provision here, but I just want you guys to take that and kind of, that's something you want to take for the rest of your career. As long as you're in the architectural field, your design is that's your lifeblood. It's very important. So, okay, 7.1. The owner architect warrant the transmitting the instruments of service or information, blah, 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 that says has permission from the copyright owner to transmit such information to you. So what happens is if copyright infringement goes all over the world, or all over like all the spectrum. So like if I have a set of drawings and I hand it to the contractor and I say build this, under the copyright law, if the contractor takes these drawings and builds the building, if the contractor didn't have permission to use those drawings to build the building, the building as constructed is an infringement of the drawings. That's what happened with the house. The contractor that built that house had no idea that he or she, I don't know if it was he or she that was the contractor, was infringing on those designs by my client, the architect that originally did the Circle House. That contractor was illegally under the law using copyrighted drawings to build it, and when the construction was built, because it wasn't a picture of the drawings that won the award, it was a picture of the house. That house is what was the infringement. And so when you transmit the instruments of services, you are saying, I'm allowed to, I have permission, because I have permission from the copyright owner to give it to you, contractor, and you now have permission to build it. So that's what this clause says. You just got to make sure that you're allowed to give those instruments of services to the next person. 7.2, the architects and the architect consultants shall be deemed the owners, authors and owners of their respective instruments and services. So you own your copyright, and that includes when you hire your electrical engineer or your mechanical engineer, they own theirs. And so you want to have some long language between you as the architect, want to have the proper language. Hey, mechanical engineer, you're going to be my drawing. I'm going to put them in my drawings. Are you giving me the rights to do that because it's your copyright? I'm going to put them in mine, and I'm going to give them to the owner. Do we have the permission to do that? Everybody who creates their designs are the owners and authors of that design. That's what this says. 7.3, upon execution of the agreement, once we sign this contract, owner and architect, once you sign this, the architect grants to owner a non-exclusive license. Non-exclusive means you're not the only one that I'm giving this license to. I can give it to anybody I want. License. I'm allowing you to use that. That's the permission. License to use the architect's instruments and services solely and exclusively. This is the only reason why you can use this. To construct, use, maintain, alter, or add to the project. You can build it. You can do an upkeep. You can do an addition for it. That's what you can use it for. This project only. When I was in law school, I lived up at right down on Addison Lakeshore, right down the street from Wrigley Field. I looked out the window at there was a large open space, and they built a residential tower, I don't know, like 34 or whatever, some of those, you know, those apartment complexes are up and down Lakeshore Drive there. And they built one, and they built another one. It was a cookie cutter. It was the exact same building. It just boom, boom, boom. Kind of like presidential towers. You know, there's like four in a row. This is the exact same thing. What ended up happening was between two and three, there was supposed to be four in there, or maybe there was three, I'm not sure which. They had a falling out between the architect, and the architect had the copyright. So they had built two towers, and they were going to build a third, but they couldn't because the owner, the architect, didn't give them license for the next project. Tower one was project one. Tower two was project two, and tower three would be project three. So it's only and exclusively for the project, which is going to be defined in the initial information. And the initial information was one tower. So sometimes you get a situation where an owner knows they're going to develop two or three towers, but they only enter into a contract with the first one. And the architect gets stiff, doesn't get paid, because the owner doesn't want to hire her for phase two or phase three, and that's not fair. So the architect says, no. You can't use my drawings for phase two. You have to pay me for it. I have to be involved. Or if you don't like me, you don't want me involved, you can buy me out for a license fee or what have you, but then I have no responsibility for it. So it's important that it's for this project with a capital P, which is going to be defined in the instruments of services. That's why these capitalized terms are important. That's why when you fill out the initial information in the beginning, in that first article, why it's clear what that project is. And then it says, provided the owner substantially performs this obligation. Yes, I'm giving you a license, but you got to do what you're supposed to do, which is primarily pay my fees. The architect doesn't pay me, I'm not giving you this license, or the license will terminate. And it says, including prop payments. So that's my lighting scenario. My lighting designer gave a license to the owner in that case to use their reflective ceiling plans. Once the owner stopped paying my lighting designer, they lost their license. This is the provision we use. The license granted under this section, if we continue on, permits the owner, so now the owner has the license, I got it in hand, permits the owner to authorize the contractor, subcontractors, etc., as well as their own consultants, my kitchen designer, to reproduce applicable portions of the instruments of services, again, solely and exclusively performing the services and construction projects. So, architect says, I'm giving you a license, owner, to use my drawings. If that's all this provision said, the owner would have to build everything themselves. But it continues on and says, I'm allowing you to give it to the contractor and to other people to use that. So when they actually build it, they're not infringing. So it's a logical progression, but over the years, there have been times where contractors have used it for this project or the next project. Where a lot of this bore out of this language in here and how this works, and then some changes in the Architectural Copyright Act in 1990 was when subdivisions and subdivision developments became really popular. And I actually went to school. Have you guys, everybody ever heard of the developer Pulte Homes? They're big, huge. They're probably one of the largest home subdivision developers in the country. And I went to school with one of the Pulteys. Nice guy. They did really good work. But there was a lot of these companies that kind of came up in the 70s and 80s. It was his father, where they would develop subdivisions. And so you go in, and you go into the Pulte Home Division subdivision office, and you know there's a subdivision being built. And you go in, and there'll be like the Georgian, the Colonial, the Ranch. So they have like five different sets of designs. And they're going to be sprinkled, 150 homes throughout the subdivision. And you can say, oh, I like the Colonial. Will you build that in this lot here? You pick a lot, you pick a house, they build it. Or they're building a number on spec or whatever. And that would happen. And they're very successful. Lots of developers had that, really good. And what would happen is there would be some more successful than others. And there may be a brochure or a flyer or what have you. Or someone could go take pictures of the house as it's being constructed because it's just out in the open. And a competitor, Pulte. Pulte was one of the better developers, and so they take pictures of the houses and everything else. And I don't know if this ever happened to Pulte, but I know this happened to some subdivision people. But they would take pictures of it. They would take the brochure, which has a little rough floor plan, and that competitor would go buy some lot in the middle of Iowa and build a subdivision and have the same houses. And that would be considered an infringement. Even if they took a picture of the house, they're like, well, I didn't have the drawings. I just took a picture of the house and everything else. And that's because they didn't have this license to use these drawings. They didn't have a license to go ahead and build somebody else. And then they actually changed. Remember when I said that the actual construction of the building is an infringement? You may not be able to connect the dots all the way back to the original drawing from the original architect, but the construction of it. The Architectural Works Copyright Act of 1990 said the physical structure, as it's constructed, can be itself an infringement of the original design. And so all of this, 7.3, is saying, architect gives you owner license. That license can transfer down to the contractors, but all of it is tied to the project, which is in the initial information, and that's it. No further. So, any questions on that? Yes? Yes. No, what you want to do in that situation is what I would recommend, and I have this for a project, for clients where I've had this, where their vision is multi-phase, is I recommend that you list in there that this is going to be a four-phase project with phases to be approved as you go forward. And in fact, actually, even Navy Pier, we did this. Navy Pier had five phases, and in each phase, which was tied to a geographical location in the pier, because it's a half mile long, there were 10 sub-phases in each one. And there had to be an approval process to go from phase 1 through 10 in phase 1. We actually had the five phases were letters. So phase A had 1 through 10. Phase B had 1 through 10. So you put those all in. And a lot of the reasons why you do that on a business purpose is because you may not have the financing to do that. I don't even know how much the ultimate end dollar value of the Navy Pier development was. I'm sure it was well over probably $400 or $500 million when it was finished. I don't remember what it was. But you don't have that money up front. And so you list that information so the architect knows, and then you want to include sometimes in a contract like an off-ramp. If we decide not to go to phase 2 or phase 3, we can purchase the license for those, and then sometimes the architect will say, that's fine, we'll give you the license to do phase 3 and 4, but if you don't involve us, we don't have a responsibility if something goes wrong. And you're like, well, then the owner comes back and says, well, but if your drawings were bad, I should be able to sue you. And then they're going to say, as the architect, but if I was on the project and my drawings were bad, I would have been able to fix it because of that give and take with the contractors. So, yes, you try to do that, but you have to build in a lot more terms and conditions of how phases are going to be triggered, whether the financing comes in, who's got responsibility. I've done all of this. All of this can happen on various projects that you do. But it's a good thing for the architect because they want to protect their interests. It's a good thing for the owner because they can keep that architect on board if they want to, but they have an off-ramp. So, yeah, you very definitely could have multiple phases listed in that agreement. Okay. 731. In the event the owner uses the instruments and services, and this goes, what happens when you do, whether you have the phases listed or you don't have them, if they use the instruments and services without retaining the author of the instrument service, the architect, the owner releases, not your fault, the architect and the consultants from all claims and causes of actions arising from such use. If I decide to use your drawings on phase two, and I don't hire you, and the building falls down, I can't sue you because I release you from all claims and causes of actions. This is the architect saying, if I was there, I could have prevented it, but you didn't keep me on board. I know it's my drawings, but you didn't keep me on board. So, as an owner, this is not the best provision for me, so I'm going to tweak this a little bit. As an architect, that's great. So that's what happens when you look at it. It depends on me as the lawyer who you represent. But this is what's saying is, if you use my stuff without me being involved, that's your problem, not mine. So then it says, the owner to the extent permitted further agrees to indemnify and hold harmless. Remember a couple weeks ago I said, the only thing you got to remember about indemnity is this third party action. That's some third party suing you, not the architect and the owner. So if what happens in this scenario where the owner agrees to indemnify, so owner goes to phase two, wall falls down and it's bad design, the person living in that apartment gets hurt, they're the third party. That person sues the architect because it's a bad design. The owner now must indemnify, meaning the owner must pay for and protect the architect. Not only can the owner sue the architect, but the owner now has to protect and pay for if there are damages by that third party getting injured because you used my drawings and I wasn't around. Yeah, it fell down and yeah, it was bad design, but I could have prevented that. So not only can you not sue me, but you got to pay for any costs that this poor injured person is suing me for. So it includes costs of defense, related claims, etc., etc. So this is a really, really good provision for the architect. But then it's like, man, this is so one-sided. We have to get some clawback here. And it says, the very last provision says, the terms of this section shall not apply if the owner rightfully terminates this agreement for cause under section 9.4. 9.4 we'll get to in a second, but 9.4 basically says, if you, the architect, screw up so badly that I have to fire you, and I am justified in firing you. You're not delivering the drawings on time. Your drawings are really bad. You can't do your work. Whatever the issue is that the architect fails to do. But they've designed half the project, or the project is even under construction. The owner shouldn't be required to have to go back to the drawing board, because remember, the architect owns the copyright. If you fire the architect because they're so bad, should the owner be penalized to have to start from scratch? That's the provision that last sentence says, no. I can use your drawings to continue on to finish this. Maybe not phase two, but certainly to finish the phase one project that you were working on. I can use them because you were so bad, I terminated you correctly for a cause. And I, as the owner, shouldn't be penalized. So lots of good protections for the architect, for the owner going rogue and using the architect's drawings. And that's fair. But a protection for the owner here, if the architect was so bad you had to get rid of them, and the owner had to go on their own. That's fair too. So that's what this provision... And it's good. Owner spoke up and said, wait a minute, what happens if I'm getting screwed over here? I have to be able to protect myself, and I shouldn't have to start from scratch, tear my building down, because as we construct it, everything that's being constructed is going to be infringement of their drawings. So that's where this whole thing comes in to kind of protect. 7.4, except for the license granted under this article, so this is the only world where licenses are, no other license shall be granted under this agreement. And any other use of the authorized use of the instruments of service shall be at the owner's sole risk and without liability to the architects and the architect's consultants. Again, good provisions for the architect. Any claims on copyright, or questions on copyrights? Okay. Claims and disputes. Only the architect shall commence all claims and causes of actions, whether in contract, tort, or otherwise. Remember, you can have lawsuits in contract or tort within the period specified by applicable law, but in any case not more than 10 years after the date of substantial completion of the work. I can't remember. I think I talked about statute of limitations, right? The 4-year statute of limitations and this, the 10 years. Did I talk about that, of when you can know? That's what this provision is saying. The period specified by applicable law is what your state statute of limitation is, but in no case no more than 10 years. So as an example, we have this really weird law in Illinois. It's the longest, I think, in the state, in the country. We have the 4-year statute of limitations, but we have a 10-year statute of repose. So if something isn't actually discovered until 9 years and 364 days, there still would be another 4 years after that to file a lawsuit. But if they find it out in year 2, then it's only 4 years, so it's less than 10, so it's just kind of sliding scale. That's the combination of limitations and repose together. Illinois is kind of weird on that. If you go to Wisconsin, but Minnesota and Michigan, 6 years across the board, anything else. You got 6 years to file a claim whenever you figure it out, and you got 6 years to find it, and that's it. 666 across the board. So that's the applicable law in Minnesota. So 6 years, it would never be able to bring any claim against the architect, anything outside of 6 years. In Illinois, it could be up to 14, except for it says, but in any case, not more than 10 years. So if you're signing a contract in Illinois, if you're the owner, you want to strike this case because this gets rid of that 10 plus 4. So the owner wants this to be as long as possible. The architect wants to keep that in Illinois. In this part, it doesn't matter in Minnesota because Minnesota says applicable law 6 years. It cannot go that 10 years. So there's this trying to capture that different states have different statutes as far as how long you can bring a claim. 8.1.2. To the extent damages are recovered by property insurance, so the owner buys property, they have insurance on their property. The owner and the architect waive rights against each other and against contracts, blah, 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 to the extent that such rights, the proceeds of such insurance set forth in the AA documents. What this basically says is, let's say that you have a project and it's built and it burns to the ground after you've moved in. Happens. It turns out the fire is caused by faulty electrical. That's a design error. The owner's property insurance is going to pay, if you have fire insurance, for the rebuilding of the building, most likely. This provision says that's who should pay first. It's just a ranking of it. And then it says, except to such rights that may have to the proceeds of insurance set forth under the AIA 8201. So there may be other insurance that could be available, but basically this is saying is once you move in and the property insurance kicks in, that's who's going to pay to protect the architect or what have you. Sometimes there's fights between insurance companies and otherwise, but that's what this is trying to cover. 8.1.3. The owner and the architect shall waive consequential damages for claims, disputes, and other matters in question arising out or relating to the agreement. Anybody know what a consequential damage is? That's good, because most lawyers don't know what consequential damage is either. Think about a construction project. The best way, by the way, consequential damages occur not just in construction. It's very common. This is what's called a mutual waiver of consequential damages. The best thing I wanted you to take away from this provision is make sure this provision is in every single contract you sign. Every single one. Mutual waiver of consequential damages. Here's why. There are two types of damages for your purposes that you want to understand. Direct and consequential. If you design a space and the wall falls down, the cost to rebuild that wall is a direct damage. It's directly applied to your design. If your designs are late and it causes a delay to the project, the cost for those delays are directly related to your design. To build the project, just to how long the project is to construct. If you design a project and your design causes the project to be late by 2 months, and I lose 2 months of making candy, that is a consequential loss. You have to, if your designs cause the project to be 2 months late, you have to pay for the cost to keep the contractor on board for 2 extra months, directly related to the project. You don't have to pay for the consequence of that, which is the loss of revenue of selling candy. So a consequential damage is an indirect, not related to what the project was actually being for, the building of it, not for the operations of it. There are many consequential damages, lost profits, loss of revenue, loss of business, loss of communication, having to pay staff more, lots of things that fall into this. The reason why you want to make sure that this mutual waiver of consequential damages is in every contract you sign is because the consequential damages are often significantly higher than anything in the project. Remember I talked about liquidated damages a couple weeks ago, and I said I work on projects for the energy industry. Some of our liquidated damage was worth $500,000 a day. And the owner was not fully compensated for its loss. The owner and these electrical companies, the amount of electrical energy that they would lose was in the millions, but they could only negotiate up to $500,000 a day. Those are all consequential damages. It's not related to the actual factory. So consequential damages can be astronomical. So you as an architect don't ever want to carry it. I gave the example of the casino. They were making $1 million a day in just the slot machines alone. That's a consequential loss. So that's why you want to waive those. And you buffer, the owner buffers that back with the liquidated damages. It happens for the flip side too. And it's more probably to protect the owner too, but not as much. But it more happens in the construction side. But if I am a contractor and I have my A team on your project, and you as the owner and the architect or whatever screw up and cause the project to be delayed, I may not be able to take my A team to my next job to pitch it. I may lose future business because I don't have my A team there. And that would be revenue. Oh, God, I had to finish your project because you screwed it up. I lost a $1 billion project or whatever it might be. That would be something you, if you didn't have this waiver, the contractor could sue the owner for and say, I lost future revenue. So the owner doesn't want that responsibility too. So that's why it's mutual. But this is important to have in every single clause, any contract you ever sign. Mutual waiver of consequential damages. Mediation. We talked about different dispute resolutions. So mediation under the AAA contract is mandatory. Any dispute or other matter arising out of related to these shall be subject to mediation. Mediation is that non-binding kind of business relationship, business type way to solve a dispute. So every AAA contract requires mediation first before you go to either arbitration or litigation. 822, you shall endeavor to resolve claims and disputes and matters and questions between them by mediation. So this kind of just goes through and describes the mediation process. So you got to try to resolve by mediation. You need to mediation proceed in advance of a binding dispute resolution would be arbitration or litigation. So it just says you have to go through this process. 8.24. This is a change from earlier version. This says if you can't resolve it through mediation, your next step would be one of the following: arbitration, litigation, or other. And you have to actually physically check the box of what you want to do. As a general proposition, over the 30 plus years that I practice law, I always say litigation. And the clients always come back and I'm like, oh my God, litigation is so expensive, we have to go to court, we have all this other stuff, and all the requirements and restrictions and everything else. And I say to them, arbitration was invented a long time ago to be cheaper, faster, better. It's not. It's just as expensive. Litigation, you can appeal. Arbitration, you can't. Litigation has rules that you need to follow. Arbitration rules, who knows what happens in arbitrations. Other, you can mix. There's different things to do. There's like a meet arb. There's some other things you can do here. The arbitration, the only time that I ever do arbitration is when the client says, a lot of times if you're dealing with a high-profile client, they don't want their name in the press. Sometimes you have, like, like some of the work that I've done with some private foundations. They're not an individual, but because of the way the foundations are set up, they don't want that to be put out in the public sector, so we'll do arbitration for them. But by and large, my recommendation to you as an architect, unless you are forced to do that, I would recommend that you check the litigation box. I think it's much safer. Some people say it's more expensive. It's not been my case to see that arbitration is any cheaper. Doing this for years, so. And then there's a series of provisions, arbitration. If you're going to do arbitration, they have a series of provisions. You're going to use the American arbitration rules and blah, blah, blah. So this just kind of goes through under 8.3, and it's some paragraphs talking about how arbitration is put together. We don't have to go into any great detail of those on this provision, this today. I think the only thing I want you to kind of take away from this Article 8 is you must do mediation. My recommendation is if you can't finalize it by mediation, pick litigation. If you got to do arbitration, talk to your lawyer about how to proceed through these provisions, and that's about all you need to worry about under Article 8. Article 9, termination or suspension. So now this is the part where something went wrong. You know, we have all the good stuff before, like this is how we deal with things, blah, blah, blah. Now what happens if something goes wrong? If the 9.1, if the owner fails to make payments, so this I always find kind of fun, not fun, but interesting at the very least, is clearly this is written by architects, because the first failure is the owner failing to pay. Now, if this was an owner-drafted standard form agreement, the first 9.1 would say something if the architect does something wrong. So, I mean, obviously it's logical, but it starts out, if the owner fails to make payments, such failure shall be considered a substantial non-performance and cause for termination, or at the architect's option, cause for suspension of performance of services. If you don't pay me, I, architect, can terminate this contract. You need to pay me or I'm out. I'm allowed to do that. That's termination for cause, and the architect can do that. Or I'm going to say I'm putting pencils down or keyboards down. I'm not going to be doing any design work until you catch up and pay me. It's fair. There's nothing secret about this. You got to pay me for my services. So I think that's okay, and it should happen to do that. You have to give 7 days written notice. You can't just stop working or walk out. You got to give them at least notice about that. And then before you start services again, let's say they make up and they pay you, well, you got to be paying me everything on due. Like, you got to catch up. And if I incurred any costs for interruption, you got to pay me for that. So it's a pretty straightforward pay provision. If you didn't pay me, I can fire you, or I as an architect can fire you as my client, or I can stop. And if I start up again, you got to pay me in full and whatever cost I had hanging out before that. 9.2. If the owner suspends the project, maybe the owner's cash flow is slowing down. Maybe there's, I'm not sure, we have problems with the board and we have to change what the design is. Maybe there's, whatever it is. The owner says, pencils down. The architect shall be compensated for services performed prior to the notice of suspension. So you got to pay me until you sent me the letter that says, stop. You got to pay me for the full. Even if you're having problems with me, you could be suspending because you don't like my work, but I get paid until you told me to be suspended. And then when we resume, I got to be compensated for my downtime. Again, fair. This is when the owner suspends, as opposed to 9.1, the architect was allowed to suspend. Under 9.2, the owner may say, I'm going to suspend. And the fees, if the suspension, sometimes, you know, financing takes a while to kick in, and maybe it's 6 months. The architect's fees may go up because they go up on an annual basis. The architect's allowed to adjust their fees if necessary. 9.3. If the owner suspends the projects for more than 90 cumulative days, so combined, it's like 10 here, 25 here, 90 here. So it's not 90 consecutive, 90 cumulative days, for reasons other than the fault of the architect may terminate. You keep starting and starting and starting and stopping and starting and stopping. That interferes how I'm running my business. I need to be able to plan where I'm putting my A-team. And if you start and stop and start and stop, I'm allowed to get out. Now, most architects won't do this, but you're allowed to under 9.3. And you still got to give 7 days written notice. 9.4. Either party may terminate this agreement, either party, not less than 7 days written notice, and should give the party if the other party fails substantially to perform in accordance with the terms of this agreement, through no fault of the party initiating termination. So obviously we've seen that termination can be for failure to pay by the owner, but since this is either party, this allows the owner to terminate if the architect's not doing its job. And if you remember in 7.3.3 it said, or 7.3.1, I'm not sure which one of the provisions was, but one of the 7.3s said this provision doesn't apply if the owner properly terminates under 9.4. So 9.4 says, I, owner, can fire you if you substantially fail to perform under this agreement. Okay? 9.5 is a unique one. Architects don't like this one, but the owner's paying the money, so that's why the owner can have this provision in. 9.5 says, I can terminate this agreement after 7 days' written notice for my convenience and without cause. I don't like the color of your tie. You're fired. That's all they need to know for the owner's convenience. They don't have to have any rhyme or reason. They can terminate this contract at will along 7 days' notice. That seems pretty unfair to the architect, right? But it's the owner's project. It's the owner's money. They can't be forced to stay into this agreement if they don't want to. Now, there are provisions like 9.6 in the event of termination not fault the architect, because obviously for convenience, the architect didn't do anything wrong. If they did something wrong, they'd use 9.4. 9.5 is, I just don't like the color of your tie. So 9.6 says if it's not the fault of the architect gets compensated for his services. So the architect should be paid for the work they perform, and the architect still owns all of their copyrights. So the owner can't use those drawings. So it's actually not to the owner's best interest to say, I don't like the color of your tie, you're fired, because the owner can't use those drawings. Because remember, that 7.3 provision only allowed the license to continue if the termination was under 9.4. If you terminate under 9.5, the owner loses all the rights to the drawings, and the architect gets paid for it. So this provision, while it's the owner likes that because I can just walk away when I want, you rarely see this exercise because it's catastrophic to the entire project. It's bad for everybody. Where you'll see maybe 9.5 exercises is the very beginning. Hey, we signed a contract. I really thought you were cool. I liked your design when we first started talking. You sit down at the schematic design page and you're like, oh my God, the project is way too expensive. I can never do this. We're done. Or, oh my God, I thought you were really great in our first two meetings. There's no way we're going to get along. You might be a wonderful designer, but we're just not on the same language. So early on, they may exercise that provision, but it's really detrimental to everybody's cost, benefit, and everything else if you try to do it later on in the project. 9.7. Termination expenses. And this is a capitalized term, and you can define what those termination expenses might be. Are in addition to the compensation for the architect services. So I get paid for all the work I did, billing hourly, whatever my rates are, up until I'm terminated. But then there may be additional expenses, termination expenses, which you would define. And then they're attributable to which the architect is not otherwise compensated. So you go through and say, I get what the work I've done thus far, plus maybe some walkaway fee, some buyout, some other expenses that I may have. Any questions on termination and suspension? Article 10. Miscellaneous provisions. So we have these kind of catch-all now that we got to move in here. So, if you're going to do arbitration, we talked about that one. The Federal Arbitration Act shall govern. So there's different acts of different types of arbitration. So this is just telling lawyers, pull out the Federal Arbitration Act. These are the rules you have to follow, in addition to the other rules that were identified. 10.2, terms of this agreement shall have the same meaning as those in the AIA 8201. This is always, I found, the weirdest thing about the way the AIA contract documents are written. The word instruments of service, which is what the architect creates, is nowhere defined in this agreement. It's capitalized, so we know it's a defined term. It's not defined here. It's defined in the A201, which we'll talk about in a few weeks. And you know you want to have it defined in the A201 because the contractor has to know what the instruments of service are, but you would think if it's the product that the architect is creating, it should be the B101, but it's not. So in order to close that gap, it says it shall have the same meaning in this document. So sometimes I've had this scenario where the architect enters into this B101, The term instruments of services are used throughout. Owner enters into a contract that's not the A201 with the contractor. It uses the term instruments of service. It has a definition in there. That definition in the owner-contractor agreement is different than the definition in the A201. This is the definition that applies to the owner-architect because it specifically says use this definition. The definitions of the owner-contractor agreement applies to the terms between the owner-contractor. So you have this inconsistency. And then what do you do? Does this definition in the owner-contractor agreement, is it as all-encompassing as in the A201? Is the contractor infringing on the instruments of services because their definition is more narrow than the architect's definition? And you have to try to work that out. And that's something you want to make sure. That's why you want to use the same suite of documents. I mean, I tell my clients, the only time I've had this scenario come up is when my clients signed the contract and they came to me later. I wasn't involved. But if I say we're starting with the B101, any AIA document, every document used from here on out in this project, whether it's pay application or anything, should be AIA forms, just to keep consistent. But this is a protection to the architect. Because they, and it's a good one, the architect likes the definition of instruments and service that sits in the A201, so we know what it is. 10.3. So, 10.3 says, owner-architect respectfully bind themselves, their agents, successors, assigns, and legal representatives to this agreement. So that just means, like, sometimes you'll be working on a business, you're working for an architect, maybe you're a small shop, and you're on a project, it's a two-year project, and some other larger architect has caught your eye, or maybe you found somebody you like, and you merge. Well, now you're a new business, but you have all these continuous work that was existing. So that would be a successor or a sign. So what happens is, the terms of this contract that were entered into with Mike's architecture firm, if it becomes Mike's and Julie's architecture firm, everything kind of transfers over based on this provision. You can't just say it's just Mike or Mike and Julie's unless there's some other legal language. So that this is just a flow when it happens. Or if an owner is bought out by a larger company, then those obligations still apply to the next company going forward. 10.4 you don't have to worry about. 10.5. Nothing in this agreement under 10.5 shall create a contractual relationship with or cause of action in favor of a third party against either owner or architect. Now, this third party could be the contractor, it could be the person walking on the project site, it could be anybody. This says owner and architect have obligations to each other. No one else is part of that. No one else outside of that world other than owner and architect can rely on this contract as an obligation owed to the third party. Now, they can use arguments. I have a really good friend. He's a plaintiff's attorney. And years ago, he called me up. He's like, "Ian, I see this provision 10.5. What does this mean?" He's a really funny guy. He's a really good lawyer. But he always kind of talks to him. He's like, "What does this mean? I got this plaintiff. There was an injury. The thing fell down on him. Can I use this contract?" And I'm like, "What do you mean, Dave?" And he's like, "I just want to use this contract. Can I use this provision?" I'm like, "No, you can't use the provision. But you read it." Like, he's really smart, but he just looks at it and he's like, "This doesn't mean, like, yeah, except what it says. You can't use this contract. If your injured party can't use this contract as an obligation contractually owed to your client." It's like, "Well, that's stupid." And I'm like, "But Dave, you can bring a tort claim. And a tort claim can say you as a tort, because standard of care is a tort concept that's been contractually added to this agreement." I'm like, "You're bringing a tort claim. He was injured. So you want to say that the architect had obligations under tort, standard of care, and those obligations were defined more furtherance under this agreement. So you're not going to say that the architect breached a contract with your client, but you're going to say they breached the standard of care in general, and that standard of care was defined." And he's like, "Oh, that's a good idea." And that's what he's done. This was years ago when he first started practicing. But I remember having this conversation specifically about this provision. He's like, "That's really stupid." "It's okay, we'll get through it." And he's used it. And then that's what happens. Is you can use an architectural agreement when you're a third party, but you can't say there was a breach of that agreement to your third party. It's just you use it as an establishment of what the architect should have been doing, or the owner for that matter. There's obligations the owner may have. 10.6. The architect shall have no responsibility for discovery, presence, handling, removal, disposal, exposure, or anything to hazardous materials or toxic substances. And this kind of goes back to your question about the soil samples and why would you not have the architect to do this and everything else. You own the land, so if you as the owner come in and your land has contaminated soil, the architect doesn't want to have anything to do with it, and you as the contractor. And if the architect starts doing soil borings and doesn't detect the right soil samples and where the contaminants are, the owner may look back to them and say, hey, you should have known that. It's not my problem. So this is basically saying, I as the architect have no responsibility for toxic or hazardous materials. 10.7. The architect shall have the right to include photographic or artistic representations of the design of the project among the architect's promotional professional materials. You want to be able to take pictures of your work and be able to use it and say, look how good a designer I am. I did this cool building, and you put it up on your project website. And that's what it says. I have the right to do that. Now, certain clients will say, you have no right to do that. Haribo did that with the architect. They said, you need to get... Not to say we won't let you, but if you want to take pictures and you want to put them on the website, take pictures, send them to us. We'll approve them. We need to see what the layout of the website's going to be. I mean, they weren't overburdensome, but they were very protective about their candy. And they said, so we will approve what's going to go on your website if we will do that. Like, so this is, you know, this is good for the architect today. I can take pictures of it. But people want to protect their privacy. A lot of private homeowners want to do that too. Question? I'm sure I'm not quite sure I'm understanding your question. So
there's online here, which the Trinity River, the JCFA building, the Northern Illinois University.
Okay.
It's like that blue to
yeah. Now I understand. So the question is, just to repeat what people can hear, the question is if you're going to be taking photographs, if you have the right for photographs or otherwise, you're taking photographs for your website or otherwise, can you, as the person that's publishing it, can you alter those photographs to your benefit to make it look better than the building really is? And the answer is, it depends. And what it depends on is the first question is, are you allowed to take the photographs? And if you are, if this is the standard language like this is, it says you're allowed to take the photographs for your promotional material and the owner doesn't have any beef in it, then the owner wouldn't have any objection and can't make any objection to whether they wanted to start to change or modify or alter the building. The thought process would be is that if it's going to go on an architect's, because it's for promotional professional materials, I mean, it is qualified representation of promotional professional materials. It's not for like something else. So first of all, you would think that the architect wouldn't want to modify it to make it look bad, to make the building look terrible. I mean, if they were trying to disparage the owner and say, oh my God, this owner was terrible, look at this crappy building that they're working in, and that wouldn't happen. So in that instance, the owner probably doesn't have much of an objection to make, and they really don't have any fight over that. The bigger question would be, is there anything that's being altered potentially of the surrounding environs where the architect taking the pictures didn't have the permission to do that? And I'm not saying that removing like a street sign or something else is that problematic. You know, I don't think the city of Chicago are going to care if they remove road signs or otherwise. So what you're getting into that is more of, is the alteration of the photograph, which the photographer that took that originally has the copyright in that, which is unrelated to the building, unrelated to the design, unrelated to the owner. The architect, the photographer has their own copyright. That's another work that's being created that can be copyrighted. If the photographer gives that photograph to the architect and the architect's promotion department changes it, that may be infringing on the photographer's photograph and if they don't have the permission for that. So it kind of, where it said it depends, it depends on what's happening and what's being changed. And then ultimately, though, the question would come to if the architect was hired, or the photographer was hired to take the photographs, but the photographer still owns the copyright, And the architect modifies it and changes the lighting and does something else and soups it up and removes stuff and whatever, they Photoshop it in and out or whatever program they use. Does the photographer actually have any damages? The photographer can say, you, without my permission, altered my copyrighted photograph, and therefore your derivation, that's a legal term, it's a derivative of the original, your derivation is an infringement of my original photograph, and you didn't have the permission to do that. But what damages would this photographer really be claiming? You know, they could, like I said, we'll talk about another lecture, statutory damages are available, but is it worth it to bring the suit? So a lot of things factor into that scenario, but by and large, what I think what would happen with anything like that is if they tweaked it, changed the lighting, whatever they may want to do to make the building look better, probably was beneficial to everybody, and I don't think anybody would probably raise too much of a beef. That's my guess. But then the other thing that's important in here, the second half, is, however, the architect's materials should not include the owner's confidential proprietary information. So they can't put on the project website, here's a building that I built, and it was $282 million. That's confidential of how much it cost to build that. Or if the owner has previously advised the architect in writing specific information considered to be confidential proprietary. Like I said, I couldn't even walk in myself and with my wife and kids into the Haribo factory after they put the equipment in. A number of months later, actually, the Today Show had a special on that because it was the first Haribo factory in America. And so, I don't know if it's Hoda or whoever was on the show, they actually got to go into the factory, and they did get permission for this clip. I saw it. It was like a 3 or 4 minute clip on the Today Show. Somebody sent it to me. And they had actually photographs of the candy coming off the line, but it literally was so close, all you could see was candy flowing down a conveyor belt. And so Caribou had very strict control as to what confidential information was allowed to be shown on TV. I mean, literally, you didn't see any piece of equipment on that, but you see this candy flowing by, you saw the bags and some trucks and... So that's what this second one is. It says even if the owner forgets or changes, doesn't change the first part, if the owner has informed the architect of certain things being confidential proprietary, the architect can't put that on their website. So 10.8. If the architect owner receives information specifically designated by the other party as confidential or business proprietary, the receiving party shall keep such information strictly confidential, and then it goes through and talks about who may be able to see it. And so, like, a lot of this comes into budgets, or actually, I mean, there were some connection points that Haribo had to provide to their architect that was still proprietary, but, you know, you can't just give it to the senior designer. You have to have some other people that have to see some of that information. So in 1, 2, and 3 kind of limits who gets to see this very special confidential information. Any questions on the miscellaneous stuff? Okay. 11. Building compensation. How do we get paid? The architect's got to get paid for it. So architect basic services. Remember, basic services is one defined, and then additional services is another defined. And it says, for basic services, that should be compensated as follows. And then there's a big blank. You can fill in the blank. There's all different ways to pay an architect. And for additional services, should be compensated as follows. Blank is another way. So what do they? So we specifically say we get paid for basic and additional services, and if they arise during the project, additional services, and 11.3, and 11.4 has to do additional services of their consultants. So these are different types of times that you're going to get paid. And how you get paid will be coming up in a couple of the sections, but I will tell you there are three basic ways that an architect gets paid, and I'll show you as the provisions come up. The first is what's called a lump sum. I will design your house for $50,000. Period, the end. Unless you change it, if it was a three-bedroom, two-bath, and you gave me all the parameters, and we all decided the additional information, it's 1,700 square feet, it's got a kitchen, living room, dining room, three-bed, two-bath, basement, whatever. $50,000 lump sum, one cost. Unless you change stuff, $50,000. That's the simplest, basic way to get paid. Second is, I'm going to charge you 6% of the cost of the work. It's going to be a $700,000 house. That's the budget. We estimate it. The bids come in at $659,000. I'm within my budget. I'm going to be billing you at 6% of that $659,000. if that's the bid, when it finally gets constructed at the end, it's $699,000, I'm going to charge you 6% of the $699,000. It's a percentage of the cost of the work. Simple, again, math, basic, and how you figure that out. Third way you get paid is hourly. For every hour I spend, you pay me. For an owner, normally the best is lump sum. As long as you don't change it, you've locked it in, you can set your budget, you can figure it out. Percentage of the cost of the work is the mid-ground between both the owner and the architect. The owner pretty much has a budget because they think they know what they can lock that price in because it's $657,000. They can do the math and say 6% of $657,000, that's what the bid came in, that's what it's going to be. It may cost the owner a little bit more if it's $699,000 to build it. It may cost the owner a little bit less if it's $625,000. But the architect and the owner can kind of figure out what that budget is based on what the cost should be to construct it. So it's not quite as locked in as a lump sum, but it's flexible. And the architect thinks it's fair because, hey, if I do have to do more work and the project's more expensive, I get paid for that too. I'm not locked in. That's the middle ground. Hourly rate, best for the architect, worst for the owner, because there's no guardrails. Oh, you want me to redesign? That's 4 more hours. Oh, you want to do this? That's 6 more hours. And it's not to say the architects are going to take advantage of that, but the owner has no control over what happens. Sometimes, though, the projects are kind of weird and wonky, or they're specialized. Like, if you want to hire someone to like, let's say you have a building that you're going to gut rehab. You don't know what's behind the walls. It's like an existing 200-year-old structure or whatever. The architects wouldn't do that by hourly rate because God knows what designs are going to be, what has to be done. Maybe we have to redo all the plumbing. Maybe we have to redo. You never know. So the architect may only bid hourly, and the owner's stuck with that. So it just kind of depends on the scenario. So that's what these are. So and it's going to say lump sum, cost of the work, percentage complete, or percentage cost of the work, or hourly. It's going to say that in these provisions. There's 11.4. The additional services for their consultants, that's the mechanical engineer, the electrical engineer, somebody downstream, it's going to be invoiced. So I get a bill, I'm the architect, I get a bill from mechanical engineer for $100,000. I'm going to pass that $100,000 on to the owner, plus I'm going to get a markup because I have to carry those costs. So this is going to be maybe 5% or 10%. That's what that markup's going to be. Or sometimes it's zero. Depends on what the architect is. But there should be, if you have to carry those costs, you're going to have a markup. That's what 11.4 says. 11.5 says, when it's based on a stipulated sum or lump sum, stipulated sum or lump sum, or a percentage of the cost of the work, so that was the first two, how do we build that? And we're going to go through this in greater detail in another lecture when we do the cost of the economics of construction. But we have these phases. Remember these five phases. And this is going to be schematic designs like 15%, design developments 20%, construction documents somewhere between 40 and 45%, and bidding negotiation 5%, and construction document phases 20%. I'm sure if I play back this tape later, my math won't get to 100%, but somehow this has got to get to 100%. And so if you're going to do 50,000, well, let's make it easier for me in math. If the fee was a lump sum for $100,000, when I finish my schematic design phase, if it's 15% of the project, I'd bill 15 grand. Pretty simple. So you want to do that. And if it's a cost of the work, the bids come in, $659,000, it's 6% of that, so that's your total fee, and you do 15% of that, 6% of the $659,000. So that's how you can bid. Because if not, if you couldn't bill for your phases, the only thing you would do is at the end, you'd send a bill at the very end for the whole fee, and that doesn't make sense. The architect has to get paid along the way. So these get filled in. These blanks get filled in. For both stipulated sum and cost of the work. Hourly, you don't have to do any of this. You just, every hour you bill, you get paid for it. 11.6. When there are costs of the work, any portions that are deleted or other not constructed, so if you remove a bathroom, compensation for those portions of the project shall be payable to the extent services performed. So if I design that 3-bedroom, 2-bath house and you remove one of the bedrooms, it becomes a 2-bedroom, 2-bath house, but I already designed the 3rd bedroom, you got to pay me for the design of that 3rd bedroom, even though you removed it from the scope. It's not there. Just because you took it out and you couldn't afford it doesn't mean I shouldn't get paid for it. So that's what this is saying here. And then hourly billing rates for the architect and the architect's consultants are set forth below. So if you're if you're billing hourly, if the architect's billing hourly or their consultant's billing hourly, you got to tell them $250 an hour for architect, $375 for senior architect, whatever the fees or the rates are. Compensation for reimbursable expenses. So just like when I was describing general conditions for a contractor, an architect has those as well. So you got like transportation, long distance services, approval authority, so these would be like permit fees, printing or reproduction, postage, overtime. So this is a list, and it goes to the next page, of what we would call the architect's general conditions. They're called reimbursable expenses in here, but these are things that you get actual costs, dollar for dollar for those. That's in addition to the fee. $50,000 for my fee, plus all my reimbursables. So, you know, models, renderings, site office expenses, anything that falls under these reimbursables, that's in addition to that fee, that $100,000 or $50,000, because it's a reimbursable. And then, if you get reimbursable expenses, because the subconsultants will have their own, like if the electrical engineer has to drive to the site, they get their mileage for that, and they're going to charge the subconsultant will be signed, the electrical engineer will be charging the architect, and the architect passes that along. So again, there's a markup for that too, just carrying a 5 or 10% markup. Compensation for the additional instruments or services. So this is, remember, if 9-5, if you terminate, you get rid of them for convenience. I don't like the color of your tie, but I still want to use your drawings. So that's under 9-5. Or if the architect terminates under 9-3, because the architect doesn't, the suspension is too long or whatever, the owner still can hold on to these drawings if they pay a licensing fee. So they don't. The owner doesn't completely get shut off, and you would negotiate what that licensing fee is up front. Now, the owner still has to protect the architect later and can't sue them, and all the other stuff that was there still exists, but the architect should get paid for the owner to use the drawings for the rest of the project. And if it went into phase two, like your question over there, it may be the entire fee. It may be like, okay, you were going to pay me $600,000 for phase one to do all this work. I'm okay with you not using me for phase two, but you got to pay me another $600,000, or maybe there'll be a discount because there's less work. Maybe you pay me $450,000. But if you want to use the entire set for a new phase, that fee, that licensing fee here, is fairly expensive. But not expensive. It's large because it's really for the value of the work, of the drawings. I mean, and that's your lifeblood. You can't like let somebody use your stuff. 11-10-1 is just talks about a down payment. 11-10-2 talks about how payments are made on a monthly basis for the services performed. So it just talks about how you just make your payments, and if they're late, you have to pay an interest rate. So you put that in. 11-10-3. This is an important one. The owner, for architects, is important. The owner shall not withhold any amounts from the architect's compensation to impose a penalty or liquidated damages, or to offset fees to pay contractors for the cost of changes of the work. So, what you don't want to, what this is basically saying is, let's say a contractor comes to the owner and says, "Hey, these drawings are bad. I need a change order." And then there's this dispute. Not sure whether it's really the architect's drawings or not. You've got to go back and forth. But ultimately, the owner has to pay the contractor $20,000 more to do the work, to fix whatever was wrong. We don't know if it's the architect's fault. We don't know if it's the contractor's fault. But the project needs to move forward. A lot of times, you will pay money to keep the project moving, because if you stop it to figure out who's at fault, the whole project stops and it's much more expensive. Time is money. The owner, under this provision, can't say, "Oh, I just got the invoice this month from the architect, and the invoice is for $100,000 worth of design services. I'm only paying you $80,000 because I had to pay the contractor $20,000, and he says that your drawings were bad. So I'm only going to pay you $80,000 because I already had to shell out $20,000 for you." Well, nobody's proven it yet. It says, "Contractors pay for cost of change orders unless the architect agrees or has been found liable." If the architect says, "You're right, I screwed up, you can withhold 20. Who's going to say that? But that would be one reason. Or if there's a judgment by some dispute, you can withhold. But you can't, as the owner, just say, "I had to pay the contractor more, so I'm not paying you." That's what this provision says. And it's fair. Do you have a question? No. All right, last, I think it's the last section. Special terms. Basically, special terms and conditions are as follows, and you fill in the blanks. So there's nothing here. See? That was the fastest section of it. I have a bunch of special terms that I put in here because, shockingly, there's stuff in here that when I, because it's mostly when I represent owners. I have some architect side, too. And I do represent both sides, by the way. Because there's things that are missing here that I think the owner should have about indemnity and some other detailed insurance information otherwise. So I have some stuff in here. Architects will add their own provisions in here, but this is kind of the catch-all. Stick in whatever you want. And then 13, scope of the agreement, basically says this agreement is everything. It's the entire, it's integrated, so if we had conversations before, if we had letters, if we had proposals, if we had anything, this is the written agreement that modifies everything in the past. Remember we talked about how you can have an agreement that says you can't modify this. Well, this one says I'm incorporating it, everything in, and now this is stuck. And this one, it says, So this is where I kind of get into where I talked before. So it says, supersedes all prior negotiations, representations, agreements, either written or oral. So whatever was talked about, whatever was discussed, whatever was on the back of the napkin, everything else, once we sign this contract, this is it. And it says, this agreement may be amended only by written instruments signed by the owner and the architect. Unless the owner and the architect have an oral agreement later on that says we're modifying this, and then you can modify it. Because an oral agreement can't modify the written agreement. This is a specific provision, like I said, because you can only modify this by writing unless the parties do it orally. So, does it mean anything? Yes, it does, because this is the signal to both parties, if you have an oral discussion, put it in writing. Because what's going to happen is later, when the owner says, I didn't agree to that, I have no idea what you're talking about, and the architect's like, yes, you did. No, we never had that agreement. The architect should have put that in writing to protect themselves. Or the architect's like, oh, you never told me about that change. The owner should have put it in writing. So this is a signal that says if you want to change stuff, you better put it in writing. But it doesn't mean that the oral modification can't happen. I think, for purposes, that's it. Even with the delay, I got it done. So, thank you for letting me use your laptop. I think we have, one more lecture, and then the midterm. Here's what I'd like to do. I can turn this off right now.